Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of A New Kind of Celebrity. I'm your host Venal and I'm excited to bring you another inspiring and insightful conversation this week. At A New Kind of Celebrity, we define the word celebrity differently. We define it as someone worth celebrating. Our guests are people who are doing incredible work to make this world a better place. Join us as we celebrate these individuals and learn from their experiences, leadership, and wisdom. Today we celebrate Erin Ganju. Erin is the managing director at Echidna Giving, one of the largest private funders in girls' education in lower income countries. Previously, Erin turned a bold idea for advancing literacy and gender equality into an international NGO, The Room to Read. Erin is the co-founder, former CEO, and currently remains a board member of Room to Read, an organization that has impacted over 20 million children in 16 countries. Among other awards and accomplishments, Erin has co-authored a book called Scaling Global Change, a social entrepreneur's guide to surviving the startup phase and driving impact. The book is a how-to guide for social entrepreneurs who have a vision to change the world and need a strong organizational foundation to do it. Erin, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. I'd love if you can start with maybe telling us a little bit more about yourself and what led you to starting Room to Read.
Sure. Well, thank you again, Venil, for having me. I really appreciate it. And I love the idea of there being new ways of celebrating great work around the world, because I'm a big believer that we all have an important role to contribute in improving the world around us. And so it's fun to be able to talk about my path and journey. As you know, I am one of the three co-founders of Room to Read, and it has been an amazing journey and part of my life. You asked about the journey, and from the early days, it really was a lot of, you know, the passion of my family that came through my parents. I think many of us are product of our homes and of our communities, and I'm certainly one. My father was a professor and was a big believer in the transformative power of education. He was the first in his family to get a college degree and went all the way through and got a PhD and became a professor himself. My mother was a social worker, one a big believer in giving back and that everybody had a role to play, as I said, in improving the world. So between the two of them, I almost see kind of my work in Room to Read being a combination of those. Also, we've traveled a lot as a family in early age. It was a passion to go explore new places. And so I very early on got a kind of an interest in understanding other cultures and being able to be sort of a globetrotter. And so that led me to my master's degree in international relations from the Johns Hopkins University. They have a School of Advanced International Studies. And so that, you know, sort of thread as well of really looking at working globally and understanding how to come together across cultures was a big part of my interests. So those things actually led me first to a business career. I started out working at Goldman Sachs as a financial analyst. I thought it was a great place to build skills. And, you know, as a new graduate, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to, you know, continue to learn and build skills. Investment banking was a, you know, great way to do that. I moved with them from New York City to Asia and worked in Hong Kong and Singapore. And then I got a little burnt out, you know, to be honest, and wanted to sort of find, you know, different ways to explore the world. And so I actually moved to Vietnam. And this was at a time in the mid-90s when they were really opening up to foreign direct investment. And it was a very new time for Vietnam, which was actually a very transformational experience for me. Living and working in a country that was really, you know, developing and changing a lot allowed me to sort of see, you know, what a value education really had to poverty alleviation. It was such a critical component to, you know, individuals, families, communities being able to be pulled out of poverty through, you know, sort of the game-changing opportunities that the education can provide. And so that was the early days, actually, of Room to Read with some of my early work in communities. I was working for Unilever at the time as setting up their business, but also we did a lot of community service work to build relations with the government and with communities. And that sort of led me to see, you know, the power of helping to support communities. And that really started and piqued my interest in the early days. And then luckily I met my other co-founders, and they had started some work in Nepal, and I started the work in Vietnam, and, you know, we eventually all sort of solidified our commitment to starting an organization. Nepal and Vietnam were our two, you know, key first countries, And that were the early days of Room to Read. And then we've continued to, you know, scale it. It's been an incredible journey of adding new countries and new aspects and deepening our work. But it's always really been based on this principle that every child everywhere deserves a quality education in their local communities to reach their full potential and contribute to improving their lives, their families, and their communities. And so that was sort of how I think the story of my own life intertwined with Room to Read and really became so much work in the social sector. It's a work of passion, a work of your own values aligned with your work and being able to actualize that into an organization.
Right. That's so lovely and very interesting, like completely different places. So can you talk to us more about what were the early models or early days of Room to Read and how did that sort of evolve in the pursuit? Because I know from a little bit reading that I did that it was customized and implemented also differently in different geographies. So I'd love to sort of understand what was the earliest model you envisioned and then how did that evolve over the years?
Yeah, great question. Well, I would say, you know, it really, in our belief, there was this concept of education and the importance of it. There was also this concept early on of girls often being left out the most in many communities, and that one of the best ways to ensure that girls have an even playing field is to be able to ensure that they have access to quality education. So there were certain core components to focusing on early grade reading and writing as such a huge need to, you know, improve the quality of education and to have a kind of gender lens to what we were doing. But within that framework, as you say, the early days, we focused on being able to be innovative and experimental in each of the communities that we were in. The core for us was to listen to the communities and understand their needs and be responsive to that. Hmm. We were very aware that we were sort of outsiders in some cases, you know, in terms of coming in. And so we wanted to hire and work with local country staff. And that's been a big part of Room to Read's model in each of our geographies, from the country director all through the programming staff. It's local nationals. It's not expats running those programs. And so we really had a strong belief on finding great visionaries and passionate educators and international development, you know, professionals in the countries that could work with us to understand how to adopt and adapt the model to that country context. And that allowed us, I think, to really be innovative, as I was saying, and kind of experiment and developed our program model from country to country. And actually, in many ways, we're able to take great new ideas and best practices hit in on one country and share and learn from those. So we used to have a country management conference every year where we bring sort of the top leaders in each country together to share and learn from each other, because we always found ourselves our own best teachers and our own best students within the countries themselves. And that really, I think, was part of the richness of Room to Read, is that being able to share across the context and experiment together and learn from each other. So that was certainly a key part of our early days. I'd say the other thing we did relatively well at Room to Read from our early days was embrace the fact that we needed to focus on fundraising, that to fuel the engine of our growth, understanding how to engage and develop a wide array of stakeholders in our work was really important. Fundraising, oftentimes I hear it kind of looked at as like, oh, the dirty work you have to do in the nonprofit sector to do the fun work of programs, right? And we didn't want to set up that dynamic. We wanted to really ensure that every person at Room to Read saw themselves, whether they were on the fundraising team or the program team, everyone should be able to deeply understand the programmatic work and articulate it and share the importance of what we were doing. But that also everyone should see themselves as core to fundraising, that everyone had a role in being able to tell the story, share the impact, communicate with donors in ways that really drew them into our work and made them feel a part of it. And so we really wanted to set fundraising up as a key component from the beginning. And that allowed us to, you know, a couple different ways, I think, to experiment as well. I mean, first we had a adopt a project model early on where donors could feel connected to where their giving was. So they could say, I really wanted to give to Vietnam and to understand, you know, which schools that they were establishing libraries in, or that we get a report that would talk about the community and who the teachers and the students were with some photos of where their money was going. For at relatively kind of cost-effective price points, they could feel that they understood where they were helping. And that wasn't right to make it feel like there was any sense of need to be thanked or to have any direct connection. It was just more a sense of transparency around what we were doing and how we were engaging with communities. And then we also had a chapter model, a volunteer chapter model, where we, in different cities around the globe, whether it be sort of
San Francisco or Chicago or New York, but also London and Sydney and Tokyo and Hong Kong, all around the world. We really asked people through our own networks and friends, and those grew, you know, over time, to hold an event and tell our story, introduce us to people that might be interested in our work. And so these amazing chapters would go and they'd raise awareness, they would raise funds, and they were really the engine behind our growth as well. And so I think some of the innovations in the fundraising side too helped us, not just programmatically, but also have kind of a strong foundation from fundraising that allowed us to really build a solid model behind Room to Read.
Right. And that sort of brings me to another question that I have. You know, it's incredibly challenging for many to build an organization in one country, right? And make sure that it's having impact in one country. And I think over 15, if I'm not mistaken, different countries, Room to Read is functioning. So how did that happen? Was it like an organic partnership that sort of arose? Was it, you know, more strategic in saying, okay, here's the plan on each year where we're going to go? How did that sort of expansion take place?
Yeah, I mean, that is an important part of our story. And I think that always from the beginning, we had a view of wanting to ensure that we were able to scale. We didn't want it to be one country specific, you know, particular, you know, narrow look. We saw the breadth of the need in improving education globally. And we thought that if we could develop a scalable, replicable model, we would be able to help support that growth. And so we did very strategically look at scale from the beginning and think, I mean, we used to say in the early days, kind of go big or go home. Like, we were going to do this in multiple areas and really kind of scale, or it wasn't worth sort of doing. And then that sense, we thought about ways that we could strategically think about our programming, think about our measurement, think about our operations, our fundraising, in ways that we would build for scale. And that mindset, I think, was a really important mindset to have. Right. It's not to say that that's absolutely, don't want to say that's the only way. You know, there's many, many ways to develop and create and grow organizations. But for us, we were looking at being both a breadth and a depth play where we wanted to have deep impact, but also think about how do we replicate across geographies. And so that, I think, taught us many things at the beginning, you know, in terms of how we needed to hire talent in the different countries that were really empowered, as I was saying, to develop models. It was not about control and command only from the center. It was about developing clear leadership in each of the countries, having policies that allowed us to, you know, have certain kind of key parameters that were non-negotiables in our programs that were central to what we do, but also have a lot of best practices that you could choose from that would could change across context. And so we designed everything in that way where there was like what was core and needed to be the same and what was could differ and vary, you know, all colors of the rainbow. And that kind of model, I think, in our operations really allowed us to scale. It also, I think, the key point around hiring top talent in each country, you can't, you know, underestimate how important it is to focus on great hiring, because straight from the top in each country, the your leadership, you know, set the tone for your work. And really, they were our key to establishing a organizational culture across Room to Read. I always loved hearing from many of our partners and stakeholders, they're like, oh, you know, those Room to Readers, they're always so, you know, passionate. They're always so hardworking. They just have this entrepreneurial spirit. And you'd hear that whether we were in Laos or South Africa or India, right? And so it was fascinating that we somehow were able to build these core characteristics of our culture, even though we're across very different country cultures, right, and contexts. And in many ways, I see, I mean, the wonderful part about my job now, I'm managing director at Akinda Giving, which is a private funder that is one of the largest funders that invests in, particularly with a gender lens. And so it's fun now in my role to be able to take some of those lessons around how we worked in different contexts and what we did and share them with others, but also just to learn how there are so many models out there. I mean, you know, we try to connect our portfolio and lessons that we're hearing about what works and what, you know, benefits in children in one area and how we look at changing gender norms. It's often a lot of it is translatable. And so it's fun now in my current role to also think about how do you learn and share together across these geographies. I think there's some things that are obviously very specific and important, but there's a lot of lessons that can be teased out, and we can do a better job as an education sector also understanding from an evidence base what's really working, what's really working best for teachers, what's really best for students, how do you change education systems. And you know, that is important to us at Akinda Giving, is finding those lessons to translate across our portfolio as well.
Lovely. That's really exciting to hear just similarities, like you mentioned, the culture across so many geographies, despite being so spread. So I think that's really interesting. Do you have any stories or anecdotes from the early days that sort of have just stayed with you and are as vivid as they happened back then?
I mean, yeah, I definitely am a big fan of spending time. I think it's important to ground yourself in visiting the work and understanding the intense kind of environments that we're working in. I will say even now today in our work as a funder, we find it really important. It's hard during COVID times, unfortunately, right. But we find it really important to ground ourselves in the realities of, you know, the complex environments our grantees are working in. But during the Room to Read days, in the early days, you know, I remember one of the trips that I made to Laos. It was in the, you know, first couple of years of starting up the country. We're on the way to a new region where we were going to be starting programming and working with local government officials to sort of explain the model and engage them. And along the way, there were a few schools that we had already started working in and opened up libraries in. And of course, as you travel, you need to get up, you know, very early and be on the road by, you know, 6, 7 a.m. for the long drive out into the provinces. And so we were stopping by this school before school had opened. And we said, well, let's just check in and let's just see what's happening in the libraries early, you know, well before school was going to be open. And there was a girl there that was already like reading, you know, in the library. And we asked her, you know, through my our country staff and translating, we said, oh, you're here so early. She said, yes, well, this library has been here for a few months. And my goal is to work my way and read every book in the library. Wow. And she, you know, had been keeping a list and had been making her way through the, you know, the entire contents, wow. You know, hundreds of books in the local language. And we were saying, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she said, my desire is to be a teacher. I want to be able to pass on my love of learning to other students. And I think that pay it forward sort of idea is seen over and over again, whether it's teachers, whether it's students, and so many people in the civil society, nonprofit sector. I think there's, you know, this huge sense of a kind of responsibility. And she was already at a very young age feeling that, her own words, she had this, you know, wonderful opportunity to have this window to the world of a library in her community. And she wanted every kid to grow up to be able to have that. And I do think books and libraries and schools really are a huge important connecting factor. They really are a window to the world. They are that connection. There's so many stories I have, particularly from our girls' education program, of parents talking about hope that they had for their children, and that they knew, particularly many mothers would share how they never graduated from third grade or fourth grade. They had to drop out of school, and that really limited their life opportunities. And their greatest desire for their children were to be able to graduate from secondary school. And in hundreds of communities that Room to Read works in, this is the first set of girls that are in 12th grade, right? In many cases, there'd never been a class of girls that had reached that far, and opportunities that opened for them. And so those conversations, you know, always just so meaningful to me, that could transform a family and the intergenerational impact. I mean, that's something we talk a lot about with Echidna, is, you know, the intergenerational effect of girls' education. It's huge. You know, right. If a mother is educated, it's much more likely that her children will grow up reading and writing. And that impact of education is huge.
Right. Right. Amazing. I love that story.
Go ahead.
Yes. So Erin, I remember like back when I was at Teach for India, when I was teaching in government schools, I would see Room to Read like painted a room in my school. And I think it was pretty much there in all the schools, at least in Mumbai, that I've seen. And, you know, across all the different geographies that you've worked in, this one sometimes gets a bit tricky, right? With libraries and computer rooms, it depends quite heavily on the school and the leadership of the school on whether they treat it as an infrastructure that needs to be sort of locked up, or whether they're able to sort of embed it into how the school works, right? Or the community works. So in places where you've seen it work really well, what are some of the elements that caused it to work well? And are there some places where you've not seen it work as well, and what may have led to that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually developed over time, really almost like a, you know, a rating sheet of like the key components. You know, I believe there are like, you know, 18 components of like what was a high functioning, well-working library, because we really did want to get specific and be able to engage with schools and say, here are things that are going really well and here are areas to improve. And so it wasn't meant as a judgment, you know, it wasn't, you know, a scorecard per se on judging them. It was more on explaining what are the core components and what was so important about, you know, what, how to work to, you know, to strength.
Right.
And so we would focus a lot on, of course, very important things like the collection and being able to have the books accessible, being able to have them in local language, you know, the variety of the genres of content, all of those sorts of things. There are also a lot around the teachers themselves, what was really important in terms of how you needed a librarian, how you needed to engage around kids and having simple learning activities, having things at different graded reading levels. And so you could explain to kids and understand where they were at in those reading levels, you know, many different components like that. And then of course, with the school environment, how do you get children to come into the library and work with teachers at different classes, work with school administration and principals and headmasters to understand. So just those levels, and then inviting the community in as well. How could you get, you know, one of the best ways to encourage reading and have students be independent readers with both the skills and the regular habit of reading is to help them also see others in their community that are regular readers. And so having people come in and read stories or engage with the children and build the connection, you know, as role models. So there's different components, I think, that we hit on over time. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great things now is Rindery does a lot of technical assistance projects where we work to train other nonprofits, other governments on the model as well. Right. I think that's an important part of kind of the maturity of different organizations. There's different phases. I mean, as we were talking about scaling, you know, a moment ago, I think there's different ways and times in which organizations scale. So kind of the startup days in which you're scaling. There's also the more mature phases as an organization develops a solid programmatic model, has strong evidence, has a core base of their operations, because it's not just what you do, but it's how you do it. You know? Right. So as you really build those strengths, then how can you also transfer that knowledge and the ability to help others adapt and adopt the model, whether it be government or other NGOs? And so I think that's an important sign of kind of maturity of an organization too, is to be able to have those abilities to share your model.
Right, right. And you mentioned community ownership, you know, just right from the staff of Room to Read across as well. In what ways did, say, the model or the implementation vary based on community involvement, suggestions, or the context? Maybe if you could share an example or two.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we, you know, a lot of that came from our teams. Like, so not only would they be teams based in a country, but they would obviously be more decentralized than that too. I mean, you know, India is a huge country. And so, you know, what our teams in Chhattisgarh would be doing are different than what our teams in, you know, Maharashtra are doing, and right. You know, et cetera, right? I mean, they're different constituencies and needs in those different communities. So a lot of focus was being able to hire and be able to build those relationships. Also, you know, with the schools themselves and with the provincial or state government across Room to Read. I mean, our goal was to sort of be able to work within maybe 40, 50% of schools, but then, you know, at a certain tipping point, you saw a region be able to then adopt the model and kind of scale it themselves in other schools, right? Mm. So we were not trying to work across all schools. We were really always engaged strongly with government and wanting to help be demonstration model and, you know, kind of show the power of focusing on early grade reading and writing and how to do that well and really create a new environment in the school, or with the girls' education program, how to have show the power of ensuring girls had the supports and the life skills curriculum and kind of the additional safe spaces for girls to come together and build a strong commitment to education amongst their families themselves. And that part would then translate to the community. You then saw in many of the communities we're working in that other girls would start to go to school in higher numbers that weren't even directly a part of the program, or that other, or that our reading and writing and, you know, kind of best practices and approaches in our library model would get adopted by other places. So that was, I think, kind of key to it, is being able to see that strong connection from the beginning with communities and with government, and then be able to have them scale up the work.
Right. Yeah. I think the partnership with government is really interesting. I think it always comes up whenever anyone talks about scale, especially, I think, at least in the context of India, like it's not possible without partnership with the government.
And I think in education, I think you'd see that across any of the Rindery countries, you know, that were over 15 countries that we're now in Africa and Asia, is that our belief is that education is a basic human right.
Right.
For all children, and that it is a government job at the primary and secondary level to be able to supply quality education as a founding, you know, sort of cornerstone for everyone, that should not be, you know, vary by, you know, by wealth or by where you were born, that should be an opportunity for everyone to access.
Right, absolutely. And now when you work with Echidna Giving, like you probably get the opportunity, like you said, to see so many different organizations and go on the ground, but also just evaluate, interact. You share many principles just from the room to read context of where you've seen success and sort of what led to that. As you sort of look at it from multiple different organizations, different models now, what principles do you see that in most successful organizations, and again, it could be the breadth or the depth, but having real impact, what sort of stands out? And in the ones that maybe you don't feel, or you feel there's still a long way for them to go, what sort of is holding them back?
Yeah, thank you. Well, at Echidna Giving, our kind of sole aim is to get more girls into better schools to live better lives, right? So we're trying to, the fun part now is being able to look at it, you know, kind of system-wide, right? And think about the different stakeholders in the, you know, kind of a robust ecosystem for girls' education. And so we, you know, like to join together with direct implementers in terms of NGO partners, with researchers, with advocates and champions that are all focused on how do we improve the quality of education for all children, with the belief that if all children are have equal opportunities, we will create a more just world. And so that is really kind of our focus now at Echidna Giving. And so the fun part about that is that we do have a very specific portfolio that we've developed of kind of best-in-class organizations working on that intersection, if you will, of quality education and gender.
Right.
And so first and foremost, the principles that we are focusing on are be accountable to girls, right? It is focusing on the disadvantages that they in particular face and how we get, by reducing the barriers for girls to education, we can improve the outcomes for them. And by nature then of outcomes for their communities as well. We're really committed to focusing on academic success. We support, you know, a lot of interventions that help to keep girls in school longer and persevere in school and perform mm-hmm. in school. And so much of that is in our adolescence portfolio, has a big component of life skills and social emotional learning, right. Which has been shown to be really critical to helping girls perform and persevere in school. So that's a key kind of piece of the work that we do. It's, you know, we focus on academic success, but we know not everything is only about academic success. It's about right. the supporting environment around the girls as well. And then we focus on how do we change social norms and gender norms. You know, one of the reasons why we invest early in early education development is because that's such a critical milestone in which it can be very pivotal moments for girls and boys and being able to understand gender. And that can in many ways be a protective force later on in life, where if you change concepts of gender and embrace a more equal perspective amongst girls and boys, they grow up believing and seeing the value of both genders, and they live out different lives and different ways that they interact together. And so I think we're really looking at those opportunities, both in early childhood and in adolescence, when we can really influence gender norms as well.
Got it. And Erin, one question, just where things have not worked, either in the room to read context or as you've been evaluating other organizations, other partners, what seems to be holding either organizations back or those centers back when things don't work as they're meant to?
Well, it's interesting because we at Echidna have really spent a lot of time trying to help collate insights, if you will, for the sector. And we've developed with the Girl Center at the Population Council an evidence for gender and education resource. It's called EGER for short, E-G-E-R.
Okay.
And it's really kind of a comprehensive and up-to-date information about the evidence of girls' education and what's working well, where is there a lot of solid evidence of what's working, and where are there challenges or not, promising best practices, but not as much evidence. So I think it's an important lens to take that is really important about what does, you know, work well and what doesn't. You know, there's a lot of information out there, and so it's kind of hard to summarize, but I think there, certainly we know that girls going to school is important, but there's a lot to be done on important ways to, I think, look at pedagogy, as we're talking about, and improve gender lens. So look at things like gender-based violence. You know, there's evidence about how certain program interventions can reduce the violence, but also what does that mean in terms of allowing girls to the academic outcomes related to that, to stay in school and perform. And so there's many aspects to what we're doing that we know, you know, certain parts of it are important, but we still need to focus, you know, deeper on understanding longer term outcomes. So I think that's one piece that we've really engaged in at Echidna that has been important. I think at the room to read context, what we realized some of the challenges about what doesn't work was really around when we got further away from understanding how to engage the community. I think when you, at times when we were scaling, it felt like some of the scale was at times too fast. It was hard to keep up with, and it became a little bit more of a cookie cutter model. And I think that's the times when we we're able to really focus on saying, okay, we need to have the right teams and the right connections with schools and governments in order to be able to, over time, reach communities, but not at a pace that lowered the quality. And I think that's a balance that you learn in many social enterprises is how do you continue to but scale at a pace that, you know, focuses on quality and efficiency and effectiveness as well.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point and probably something that everyone thinks about in this space, right? How do you balance that scale and the depth and the impact? So thank you for sharing that. Erin, as you see all of this wonderful, incredible work that you've done, you've shared some of like just the numbers in terms of room to read, etc., that y'all were able to grow. But when you think about like the biggest impact that you feel you've been able to have, what comes to your mind? Like it could be a number, it could be a story, but would love to hear what comes to your mind.
I think we definitely always measured ourselves at Room to Read by both, you know, the reach of our impact and the depth. And so I think the fact that we've been able to scale to reach over 20 million children now at Room to Read is incredible. Wow. And that we've been able to, across many contexts, been able to work with thousands of schools and also hundreds of thousands of girls and be able to change the trajectory of the quality of education and of their lives, of students' lives. You know, that is important. But we also really look at the impact we're having from a depth perspective too. When we look at our early grade literacy program, we'll measure the work that we're doing in a school compared to a school in the community, you know, down the road that is doesn't have Room to Read program. And you often see that children are learning to read and write 2 to 3 times, you know, wow, higher rates than in comparison schools. And so that level of commitment to depth of our work is really critical as well for us. And so I think the combination really, you know, kind of as I was just saying, it's both growth with quality. That is like the ideal of where you want to focus on.
Like even on the website, I think it says the scalable, replicable model. And I think to have something that is able to hit both scale as well as the quality, I think is sometimes quite rare to find. So I think that's really interesting. And I think like coming towards the close of some of my questions, and then would love to hear if there's anything on your mind in addition as well. But I'd love to ask, like, what are some maybe learnings or advice that you would like to share based on your journey with people who might be listening?
Yeah, I mean, I think from kind of parting advice or summing up a lot of the work we've done, and we did, I did co-author a book with my long-term chief program officer, Corey Heyman, called Scaling Global Change. And the idea was really kind of to be a guide for social entrepreneurs as to how do you survive that startup phase and move into driving greater impact and that more mature phase that we've talked about. I think it's an important journey. And in many ways, what we saw is that the startup days were, well, intense and very complex in terms of getting everything going. It was a high growth phase. And then you often kind of hit a sophomore slump, as we called it, or like this phase right after startup where you're not the new organization on the block. Not everybody wants to talk to you. It's harder to fundraise. It might be harder to get attention. You're a little bit of a known entity. And how do you continue to have momentum behind your work and grow again, right? And how do you kind of get out of that slump and get back to a place of growth? And a lot of that takes really disciplined decision-making, really disciplined focus on continually improving your programming, building your evidence in your measurement, being able to continue to reach to your donors and your key stakeholders, you know, whether it be government or other partners, and be able to communicate the power of what you're doing and how the model is driving impact. And all of those things are just, it's almost about building quality and consistency that you don't always see every organization kind of getting through that slump and back into growth. And so I think that for us, what was critical often was strategic planning and really knowing where we're going, kind of defining where did we want to go over the next 3 to 5 years and what were all the critical steps that we were going to have to take to get there and kind of annually pushing ourselves to just keep achieving more and more each year. And that just takes a really, again, a lot of discipline, management and leadership and strategy and planning. Again, I would underscore the importance of fundraising. A lot of what I see now at Echidna Giving in our portfolio is that many leaders aren't dedicating enough time fueling their engine and doing the work that it takes on the development, the financial development side and the fundraising side to really reach more key investors in their work. And they will often, you know, because it's the thing we like. I mean, many of us, when we start organizations, it's not like we said, oh, I want to go out and fundraise every day, right? They often would say, you know, we're passionate about the work, and you have to shift the mentality and say, but actually translating that work and bringing more people into your organization that care about it as stakeholders, as advisors, as investors, that all helps you continue to build that momentum. And so shifting the mindset around that to making it a key part and devoting a lot of time as leadership to it, I think is another, you know, key piece of advice, I would say. And I think the third and final one is that everything we did was so critical was talent acquisition and development. Hiring the best people you could, creating an exciting and fun work environment that felt allowed them to feel like they were continuing to learn and grow, that their ideas were valued, that their work was recognized. Those pieces are a large part, at least as my job as a co-founder and CEO, that I spend a lot of time thinking about creating that culture that people love to work. This is a place where they would recommend their friends work. This is where they wanted to stay for a long time and feel that they were really living their best work lives where they could contribute the most. And I think if you can create an environment like that, you know, you have something sustainable. And so those are sort of some of the key things I think we learned with Room to Read. And so I've been able to take so many of those lessons from Room to Read now and help translate that experience and kind of life lived experience of growing Room to Read for nearly 2 decades to help others. And that's such a pleasure because there's just so much great work being done out there. And I think it's, you know, to be able to help build capacity in this space is just such a pleasure.
That's amazing. I do have one thing that does come to my mind. I'm just very curious to understand, like, what were some of like the biggest challenges, either like personally for you as you've been through this journey or just in the growth journey, what were maybe some of the biggest challenges also that came your way?
I mean, I think some of the challenges for us was that we really had at different times had to look at our model and understand how to add new components. I mean, at the early days, we started with setting up libraries and printing wonderful local language books. And to be honest, the assumption there was that if students were in school, they would be learning to read and write and that they'd be able to access and use the books.
Right.
We spent a lot of time on focusing on the piece around establishing great, vibrant libraries and creating wonderful content. But then you realize like children aren't actually learning to read and write at high enough levels to access a lot of the materials. And so it was a big challenge for us to be like, well, how do we as an outside player in this space, you know, as an NGO kind of just working with one specific intervention around a library, what are we supposed to do about that? And that was a big moment because we realized we had to get more into the quality education debate. Mm. And I think the world has shifted now as well. I mean, 25 years ago was all about get butts in seats and just get children in schools and education will happen. And then right. As we succeeded, you know, to a certain extent, getting more children in school, everyone did start to realize, well, this is really a quality issue. Children aren't learning as much as expected in school. And up to 30-40% of primary school students by grade 3 are still have not learned to read or write around the world. And so we had to take that to heart and to say, okay, we need to actually help improve the quality of instruction and work with grades 1 and 2 teachers and help build their capacity and understanding of how to teach reading, writing in the local language. And that led to a really big shift in our work and a way that we had to do it in partnership with schools. We're not trying to replace the government. We're still working all in government schools. It was a government curriculum. But how do we do supplemental activities and training with teachers to help improve their capacity and change the curriculum, you know, around the edges to be able to make it more accessible? I think the lesson that for us is you really have to be responsive to understanding where you're having impact and where you're falling short and be able to really take that critical feedback. And that's all from looking at evidence, right? We were able to look at our usage numbers in our libraries and be like, something is not working here. Right. You know, these libraries are here, but they're not being used at the rates that we want them. And then unpacking that and understanding why. And so those things I think are, you know, you do really need to always, I think, have a thick skin and be willing to take a lot of critical feedback and be open to shifting course based on what you really see happening.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think very interesting to see the evolution and the response to evidence and data. Erin, is there anything you feel we've not covered, but you'd love to sort of like touch upon that you'd like to share?
Well, I think at the end, it would be great just to touch on sort of the moment and time of where we are right now with the COVID pandemic. I mean, obviously, this has had a huge impact on education. It's been, you know, a critical time in which we've had this almost natural experiment happening in education where schools are closed. It's shifting to the homes. Parents are getting more involved. There's all sorts of different pivots that NGOs are going through to how to keep learning continuing.
Yeah.
And that's a very challenging moment for so many.
Yeah.
So I think that is something that we need to take to heart. I think it's been particularly challenging for girls. I mean, I would say marginalized communities, you know, particularly rural communities, you know, have been the hardest to reach throughout this pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And really that focusing on sort of how do you build back better and build back more equally has been critical. And so girls in many cases have been hit the hardest by the pandemic. I mean, they are more at risk of child marriage, of acts of violence, and, you know, and sexual assault, their safety, their well-being, mental health challenges of isolation. They're often more isolated than boys are. And while all of these have pile-on effects, so schools are closed, and then you are dealing with the follow-on impacts as well.
Right.
And that is huge. So I think in every crisis, there lies an opportunity. And we have to try to not just look at the downside, but look at what that opportunity is. And I think right now we're spending a lot of time with our key grantees are doing such heroic work. I think if anything, the pandemic has showed that the nonprofit sector has stepped up in so many ways.
Yeah.
While, you know, in many cases, the government and corporate sectors have really sort of stepped back, the nonprofit sector has leaned in and tried to help during these difficult times. And I think that's an opportunity to focus on how do we think about what education needs and how can we help teachers, how can we help parents, schools come back from this and focus on how important schools are in children's lives, what a huge impact they can have on bringing communities together. And so it's a difficult time, but I hope that we can see just how important it is to invest in the youth. You know, the youth of today, as we say, are the leaders of tomorrow. And many of the things we've talked about around education, around life skills, building that resiliency, focusing on the community, these are all more important now, you know, more than ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, hopefully like the silver lining does come through sooner rather than later. And we're able to not just go back to what we were doing earlier, but move forward in a really meaningful way.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Erin, for sharing all of this. I think very, very insightful across your entire journey. And I'm especially looking forward to both reading I'm eager to read the EAGER report to learn more about that work as well as your book.
Great.
Because there are similar thoughts and discussions happening at my organization. So I think we'll benefit a lot just reading that and using that as a guide. So thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, do subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. We'd love to hear your suggestions, reactions, or even guest nominations. You can DM us on Instagram. Our handle is @anewkindofcelebrity, or email us at anewkindofcelebrity@gmail.com. We look forward to meeting you soon. Till then, good luck and take care.